This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Welcome to a third program where we look into claims Earth will experience rapidly rising seas and superstorms in the coming decades. Will we experience serious sea level rise during our lifetimes? How about storms bigger than anything in recorded history? All this is suggested by a controversial new paper published in March by an international team of scientists, and that was led by the famous former top NASA climate scientist, Dr. James Hansen. The short title of the paper is Ice Melt, Sea Level Rise, and Superstorms. To get another opinion, I've contacted Dr. David Archer. David is a professor in the Department of Geophysical Sciences at the University of Chicago. I learned a lot from his excellent book, The Long Thaw, How Humans Are Changing the Next 100,000 Years of Earth's Climate. David also helps moderate the scientist blog called Real Climate. David Archer, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, Alex. Thanks to be back.
What was your role in this Hansen paper? Could you explain what a reviewer or a referee is?
Yeah, typically, traditionally, you submit a paper to a journal and the editors solicit some reviews and look at them and, you know, you get to see them yourself and it helps you to re-improve the paper and the editor uses them to sort of decide whether to publish the thing or not. This paper was published in a sort of a new online kind of format where the editors did solicit reviews from a few people, myself included, for this one, but it's also open so that anybody who wants to can leave a comment. So this paper got a comment trail that was just incredibly long. Lots of people putting in comments, some of them useful, a lot of them kind of nuts.
Okay. Well, in your book, The Long Thaw, you wrote about polar ice melt that would take thousands of years, and now the paper by the Hansen Group suggests melting could happen much faster. What is your reaction?
Well, even 10 years ago when I did The Long Thaw, it was pretty clear that there have been instances of sea level rise in the past, like the Heinrich events, which the current, even the generation today of ice sheet models can't really simulate or explain. So I always sort of expected that as we understood how ice sheets behave better and as the models improve, our, you know, expectation of how long it would take for them to collapse would get faster. So I'm not at all surprised by this, actually.
And can you help us understand the doubling time argument made in this new scientific work?
Yeah, so the simple view would be to say that the rate of an ice sheet melting is just going to be driven by whatever temperature it's at. So that would be a sort of linear response that, you know, 1 degree of warming might get you this much of a melting rate or 2 degrees might get you that much. But what Hansen is proposing, and this is not totally a new idea, is that the act of the ice sheet melting may enhance the conditions for its own melting so that it would, once it starts to go, it would be a runaway process. So the way it works is that the meltwater from the ice sheet runs into the surface ocean around the ice sheet, and it's fresh, so it's buoyant, less dense than the seawater that it's running into. So it acts to stratify the water column so that the surface of the ocean around the ice sheet gets colder as the ice sheet is melting, but then there is heat that's sort of trapped a few hundred meters down below the surface, and that warming of the subsurface water is in contact with the grounding line of the ice sheet, so it makes the ice sheet go even faster. So these Heinrich events that happened during the last ice age, they occurred kind of embedded within these abrupt climate changes called Dansgaard-Oeschger events. So there would be like 3 or 4 oscillations of temperature in Greenland from these Dansgaard-Oeschger events, and they would get more and more extreme. And then finally, at the coldest cycle of the whole envelope of cycles, that's when the Laurentide ice sheet would suddenly collapse and dump vast amounts of rocks, ice-rafted debris on the seafloor. So it was always weird. Why would this thing melt down when it's cold? You'd think an ice sheet would melt when it's warm. But Hansen is getting indications of this mechanism both from 3 different sources. One is from climate models today. Another is from observations of the real ocean today. And the third is looking at paleoclimate reconstructions. And it's kind of the raggedy edge of all of those different kind of modes of learning about the world. The ocean models that we have, and the one that he uses in particular in this paper, probably overestimate mixing in the ocean. So when you dump fresh water into it in the model, you probably don't get as strong a response as you would in the real ocean, because mixing doesn't happen as quickly in the real ocean. There's mixing for numerical reasons. Then the other part of the modeling story would be the ice sheet model, but there isn't an ice sheet model that we can, you know, tickle the grounding line with 2 degrees warmer water and watch it collapse. That's beyond our capabilities yet. So the modeling is kind of like half there. And then for the observations, there is evidence for sort of an anomalously cold patch around Greenland that may be part of our weird omega block weather in this country, possibly. And there's also this weird thing that the sea ice in the Antarctic hasn't been decreasing as much as the models had been predicting that it should. So it might be changing because of greenhouse gases, or it might be changing because of the ozone hole. But you put both of those things in the climate models and you don't get the sea ice persisting in Antarctica the way it has been. And so Hansen is suggesting that it's due to runoff from the Antarctic ice sheet, which is stabilizing the water column there and keeping the sea surface temperatures sort of anomalously cold. And then there's reconstructions from paleo data. The last time the climate of the Earth was sort of analogous to today was 120-some thousand years ago, a time called the Eemian, the last interglacial time. There's evidence for a period of abrupt sea level rise during this time, which he's also kind of incorporating into this story. The really astonishing thing about the modeling results is when you dump this fresh water into the high latitudes, you get this huge cooling in the high latitudes. And maybe we haven't seen that before because nobody's ever dumped this much fresh water into an ocean model before, but really, really strong effect. And the impact of that is to make the planet stormier, because you're making it colder in the high latitudes, and so the temperature difference between the low and high latitudes gets sort of temporarily exaggerated as the ice sheet is in this process of melting down and collapsing.
All sorts of fascinating things in what you just said. Now, I wonder, is it too early to say that these possible changes to ocean currents in the North Atlantic are responsible for that storm track that kept blasting the United Kingdom during the winter, or the recent cold spell that hit the east of North America while the west has been roasting?
Well, there is this weird omega block thing that climate scientists are talking about or trying to learn more about. You know, it's sort of like traditional, you know, meteorology more than climate science, a blocking event. And so it's not a kind of thing that a lot of climate scientists have thought about a whole lot. But between the so-called polar vortex winter and then other things that have happened, you know, more recently, there seems to be this sort of blocking pattern. And so, you know, one possibility is this persistent and growing cold patch that's been documented by my colleague Stefan Ramsdorf off of the east coast of the U.S. But there's also this weird high temperature, they call it the blob, this thing of water off of in the Pacific Ocean, off the west coast of sort of Canada. So I don't know. It's kind of in turmoil, it seems like, the opinions on what's causing this strange weather, if it's, you know, even anomalous.
Well, along those lines, one of the critics of this paper is Kevin Trenberth from the National Center for Atmospheric Research. And he raises with me one of several issues is the lack of recognition in this paper of the role of ENSO, better known to the public as the cycle of El Niño and La Niña. Can Hansen reach the conclusions he does without taking ENSO into account?
Well, I mean, Trenberth is more of a climate modeler than I am. I don't actually do climate modeling myself, so I will certainly take his opinion very seriously. I don't have an idea, though, how El Niño could affect, you know, the ice sheets melting. It seems like the main point of this paper is this positive feedback thing, where once the ice sheet starts to melt, it just sort of slips like somebody falling in a slippery bathtub. You know, once you start going, you can't catch yourself. And I don't know how El Niño would affect that. He talks a lot about sort of heat transport and the bipolar seesaw, that what happens in one high latitude affects what happens, you know, at the other high latitude, like a sort of temperature seesaw. But I don't know how El Nino would fit into that. Maybe he has ideas that I just haven't thought of. I have no idea. But I don't see where it, you know, undermines what Hansen is going for. You know, this Hansen paper is so wide in scope that it's just presents a huge sort of target cross-section for criticism. If I were doing it, I would have cut it way back and kind of simplified and just, you know, one thing at a time. But this paper is like shooting the moon.
Well, maybe really there's amazing. Three papers in there, really.
Oh, easily.
Yeah. How did the discussion go on the blog you helped moderate, Real Climate? Was there criticism there or about the process of publication or the conclusions?
You know, I don't really moderate that site. I just occasionally, you know, contribute something. My sense from talking to people, you know, I'm pretty enthusiastic about this paper, and so it comes up in conversation a lot when I'm, you know, talking to climate people about, you know, what's up. And I think my enthusiasm for it is on the strong end of the spectrum. It seems like there's a lot of criticism of the paper. But, you know, I view it as just, think of a scientific problem that you're developing a model, and eventually the model will give you a perfect simulation and totally answer the question that you're after. The best scientist in that process is going to get to that understanding, you know, first, when the model is still kind of raggedy and you have to be clever about what questions you're asking it and think really hard about what the model is doing right and what, you know, you can't rely on because it's all, you know, kind of raggedy still. You know, that's the genius of this paper.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, climate scientist and author, Professor David Archer from the University of Chicago. Well, yes, the paper from Hansen brings out the possibility of superstorms this century, larger than anything we've seen. How would that work, and do you agree this could happen?
There's a figure in the paper. It shows the jet stream. It shows the east-west velocity of air as a function of altitude and latitude. And you look at the present-day simulation or the global warming simulation without this ice sheet melting thing going on, and you got these two jet streams that are sort of up high in the atmosphere, and they don't really reach down very much. But then panel B of this figure shows where he's doing this freshwater addition from a purported ice sheet meltdown event, and you get this intense cooling in the high latitudes, which makes the temperature gradient stronger. And you look at the little blob of the jet stream on there, and it's like a drip from a kitchen faucet that's sort of dripping down. You see these velocities, and they sort of drip down all the way to the surface. So it's as though the jet stream is kind of, you make it a little bit stronger, and suddenly it's starting to reach all the way through the atmosphere and down to the surface. So there's a lot of words in the paper describing, and he says that his initial motivation was reading these geological reconstructions of Eemian time from the Bahamas. And he says that with stronger trade winds, there's just, the Bahamas are just getting hammered by these really, really big waves, long period waves that build up across the ocean. So there are various kinds of geological deposit passing on the claim that they were caused by, you know, like a boulder was pushed up by huge waves, couldn't get there any other way, or something called run-up deposits, where sand kind of gets shoved up onto the beach by really strong waves and maybe strong storms. So the evidence for really strong storms is sort of twofold. One is the results from the climate model when he doses it with huge amounts of fresh water, and the other are these sort of geological deposits. And, you know, like I said, it's all kind of raggedy edge of what we can see from these various methods now. So what's cool is putting them all together and getting a coherent picture. It kind of strengthens all the pieces, that the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. That being said, when I reviewed the paper, I said, you know, you should leave out these boulders, man. Just concentrate on the ice sheet melting positive feedback and keep it simple and sort of think about one thing at a time. And he did reorganize the paper. He totally reorganized how it was laid out and makes it much easier to understand. But he stuck to his guns, and you know, reading the finished version, I can see why he did. It is kind of a masterwork of synthesis, I think.
Well, and the man is getting older. He may be feeling like he's running out of time.
As are we all.
Yes, indeed. All right, well, this paper is so large, it feels almost like an alternative climate report. Does it contain a lot of new science, or is it an alternative interpretation of work already done?
It contains a lot of new ideas about how things can fit together. There are, for example, ideas about how the Southern Ocean controls the CO2 concentration of the atmosphere, which is a topic that I worked on and kind of gave up because nobody has been able, myself included, to figure out how to make a model of the ocean carbon cycle that actually can accomplish getting the CO2 down to the low level that you find during the glacial time. But it is very closely correlated with temperature changes in the Southern Ocean. So Hansen says, okay, there's got to be some link between the Southern Ocean and the CO2 concentration. So, you know, here's how this all would work. And, you know, I'd personally like to see it if somebody could, you know, actually describe mechanistically how that works. I'm sure an ice sheet modeler would have the same response to the paper that, boy, you know, it's cool to see how it could all fit together, but it'd be better if, you know, we actually had all the I's dotted and T's crossed and understood all, you know, all the pieces that go into this synthesis.
So if the 2 degree C safe limit, as agreed at the Paris Climate Talks, is actually dangerous, as this Hansen-led paper concludes, where do we go from here?
Well, I would have never called 2 degrees safe. I would very carefully have not ever said that because 2 degrees is warmer than the Earth has been since agriculture, you know, or even our species maybe. So 2 degrees to me always felt like bridge engineers selling you a design for a bridge that is not really all that safe, but they think it's all you can really afford. And actually in Paris, they said 1.5 degrees. I'm not sure exactly what the target is now. Maybe everybody's a little bit vague. But so 2 degrees we could get to by cutting a few percent per year kind of to where by 2050 we're sort of 80% done releasing carbon. Limiting it to 1.5 degrees, which we've already released enough carbon to get us to 1 degree now. So 1.5 is not that much further off. And given the fact that we are, you know, getting past any sort of we're not, like, cutting our emissions at all anyway, really much. It sort of seems to me that eventually what we're talking about is scrubbing CO2 from the atmosphere, which can certainly be done. It would just take energy and the will to do it and a place to put the CO2. And if that happens, the U.S., as we are responsible for a quarter of that excess CO2 in the air, we're going to get handed a big bill, and I personally feel like we kind of deserve it.
So, David Archer, what are you working on these days?
Well, I've got a paper submitted to Climatic Change that says that we were really lucky that the CO2 concentration in the atmosphere in the year 1750 was as high as it was. The CO2 in the atmosphere in the natural state is a very delicate balance of fluxes into and out of the planet. So if the sun had been just a little bit, just a few percent brighter, or if we had come to sentience, you know, 500 million years later in Earth history, or if we were just a few percent closer to the sun, the CO2 concentration could have been lower than it turned out to be. And if that had happened, the climate changes that we're seeing now would have happened earlier in time. So if it had been 1/10 of the actual value, the climate changes that we're seeing now that are arguably motivating us to go to Paris and agree to try to talk about this could have happened back in Svante Arrhenius' time in 1896 when he had a kind of wild idea about climate sensitivity, but it would have been much harder to deal with in that case. So the natural CO2, it kind of like provided a fuse that you light the fuse when you discover coal, and then it burned for 200 years before the bomb went off. And it could have been a shorter fuse, so we were really lucky.
It doesn't feel so lucky right now, but do tell our listeners about your free online climate course. How's that going?
It's great. I have two of them now. The second one is kind of an additional thing. So the main one is on Coursera.org. It's called The Science and Modeling of Climate Change. And they start a new cohort of students, I think, every month. So There are online models, and you get to interact with other students. There are peer assessment assignments and discussion forums. And so far, well, last time I checked, about 50,000 people had signed up for these classes. For free online MOOCs like this, the percentage of people that actually do the work and finish is never very high, and that's true for mine too, but a lot of people are doing it, and it's really very satisfying. The second one is a Python programming course that I just launched a few months ago for climate science.
I have no idea what Python is.
Oh, it's a programming language. It's all the rage now among young people. It's free, and it's got all these packages, so you can do all these fancy plotting, and it's not fast like Fortran, so you can't use it for actual climate global circulation models, but it's great for, you know, just doing little things.
So, as we wrap up, David, is there anything else you would like to tell our listeners?
Stay cool. Stop burning CO2. We can do this. I mean, it seems hopeless sometimes, but if it had just turned out that if we were just running out of coal now, if it had turned out that the planet just didn't have as much coal as it turns out to have had, it wouldn't be an energy problem. We're very smart about coming up with ways of you know, making money. It would just be a business opportunity. So in my mind, the climate problem, the only difficulty here is making the decision.
We've been speaking with Dr. David Archer, the well-known climate researcher and professor at the University of Chicago. David has several books out, including The Warming Papers, The Scientific Foundation of the Climate Change Forecast, and The Global Carbon Cycle from Princeton University Press. You can read many of his posts in the science blog Real Climate at realclimate.org. Find links to David's work, including videos, in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. David, thank you so much for helping us out again.
This has been great, Alex. Thank you for having me.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
The group of scientists led by James Hansen have explored the extreme possibilities of climate change this century. I'm not qualified to judge the science, but I do disagree with one of Hansen's solutions, which is nuclear power. I'm going to talk that over with one of the greatest anti-nuclear activists in America, Michael Marriott. Why is the world's most famous climate scientist helping out America's biggest electricity producer, Exelon? And why is James Hansen trying to get the people of Illinois to subsidize Exelon's dangerous old reactors in Illinois? Even stranger, why did the death of environmentalism guy Michael Schellenberger suddenly pop up with a new front group called Environmental Progress Illinois? Who is the billionaire funding all that? And why did Hansen join the board? Questions, questions. And for decades, I've relied on the nonprofit Nuclear Information and Resource Service, the NIRS, to get answers on nuclear power. The group was formed in 1978. Michael Marriott has been its executive director since 1985. Due to health concerns, Michael stepped aside for the new director, Tim Judson. But thank goodness that doesn't mean Michael has shut up. Without him, I would never have known about the nuclear swamp in Illinois and Hansen's questionable connections there. Michael Marriott, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Tell us about the reactors, technically the reactors that James Hansen wants to save.
Well, sure. And let me give you a little bit of the backstory here. Exelon is the nation's largest electric utility, having recently taken over the local utility in the Washington, D.C. area, Pepco. So it was the nation's largest nuclear utility, owns more nuclear reactors than any other, but now it's the nation's largest electric utility, period. However, they have several reactors, older reactors, located around the country, but especially in Illinois, which was their original home base, that are uneconomic. In other words, the power they produce costs more than they can get for the power. And that's because there's competition. And the competition is coming in Illinois from both natural gas and especially from wind power that's mostly located not in Illinois, but located in Iowa and Kansas and the rest of the Midwest, which are all big wind power states. So Exelon has been, for at least 2 years now, been threatening to close some of its reactors unless they get additional subsidies. either directly from ratepayers in the form of higher rates or from taxpayers in the form of some sort of legislative mandated subsidy. Now, we look at these threats, of course, as opportunities. Rather than threats, we think they should close these reactors, and we wish they'd act on these threats. But, you know, what they're really doing is just trying to gouge Illinois residents.
Yeah, but the reactors that they have, are these the same GE Mark I reactors with the holes in the bottom that helped the Japanese Fukushima reactors melt down?
Yeah, several of them are Fukushima clone reactors, GE Mark I. Two of the most threatened reactors are at a location called Quad Cities, which is on the Illinois-Iowa border. And then another one is at Clinton, which is mid-state. It's a newer reactor. It's a GE Mark III, I believe. So it has some improvements over the older GE reactors, but it's the same fundamental, what's called a pressure suppression containment design that failed at Fukushima. And is actually, and most people don't realize that, this is not that different from the containment at Chernobyl that failed, which also used a pressure suppression design. People think Chernobyl didn't have a containment. In fact, it did have one. It just wasn't very good. So, yeah, some of these reactors of that design, and these are old reactors. Clinton is the newest one by far. It came online in, I think, 1987. But the other reactors that Exelon has been having problems with, and not only in Illinois, but also in New York and some other states, are mostly 1960s and 1970s vintage reactors.
So what did James Hansen do?
Well, see, this is where it gets interesting, because Exelon really has no arguments on its side for wanting these subsidies, other than greed. They can close these reactors, and clearly there's enough power available to meet Illinois needs because it's already there. And it's underpricing Exelon's reactors. So the power isn't really needed. The cost of the power from the reactors is more expensive, as I mentioned, than the alternatives, so that's not really a good selling point. So the only selling point they have is carbon emissions. And, of course, nuclear reactors are low-carbon sources of electricity. They're not carbon-free, and the nuclear fuel chain, if you want to, you know, if you look at it as a holistic system, it is certainly not carbon-free. There's substantial carbon involved, much more than renewables, which and efficiency, which we believe should replace these reactors in Illinois and elsewhere, should and could, and in fact in Illinois especially, already are replacing them through wind power. So the carbon emissions is the only argument they have, and they're arguing that Illinois can't meet its clean power plan obligations if these plants close, which is almost certainly untrue. But for Dr. Hansen, you know, this just seems like such a stretch for him to argue that these right now three reactors in Illinois are somehow essential to meet the demands of climate change, because they're not. You know, unfortunately, you know, and I have a lot of respect for Dr. Hansen. I was writing my first piece on climate change and nuclear power. I was actually writing it the day he was in Congress for the first time, testifying about climate change and warning the world that we have to take this seriously. And so I actually included him in the article I was writing at the time. You know, this was back in the 80s. You know, I'm not going to argue I'm much more prescient than the next person, but I was pointing out then that this was going to be an opportunity for the nuclear power industry to try to revive based on climate. And, of course, that's instead of trying to revive, they're trying to merely exist in Illinois, because we're talking about old reactors. But, you know, it's just ludicrous to claim that the fate of the planet depends on these reactors in Illinois and their emissions, especially when their power, A, isn't needed in the first place, and B, can be replaced with more wind, more solar, more storage, more smart grids, and all the other technologies of the 21st century that are, you know, really how we're, later in the century, how we're going to be getting all of our power, and, you know, the time to be moving toward that faster is now.
You know, I read Hansen's book, Storms of Our Grandchildren, and there's a lot of great stuff in there about the climate. I learned a lot about the climate from it. But he, again, pushes reactors there. But there he's talking about Generation 4 reactors, a new brand of reactor which actually doesn't exist yet, but he thinks will be safe enough that we can go forward. It's a long stretch from that to go back to these 1970 reactors, a couple of which have already blown up, and say, yeah, we need to keep those going too.
Right, exactly. And that's the most disturbing thing about what's happened and about Hansen and Michael Schellenberger, who you mentioned earlier, sort of teaming up in Illinois, because Hansen has, in fact, been espousing Generation 4 reactors all along and urging environmentalists to support these Generation 4 reactors. Now, as you said, they don't actually exist, which is true. And we don't support them anyway because they, you know, we think they all have their own flaws, different from the flaws of the current reactors, but they all, you know, have their own flaws. So we see no reason to pursue them because the alternatives are available. But to have Hansen go back on what he was saying, the whole concept of safer reactors, you know, he seemed to at least understand that the existing nuclear reactors are not adequate. And when you go back to the kinds of reactors we're talking about here, these General Electric reactors that already have, you know, failed so dramatically on, as we all saw on our TV screens 5 years ago, that is a real change. And it's a very disturbing change because it means that he's really not understanding the nature of the risks from nuclear power. In Illinois in particular, not understanding the realities of what's been happening in that state over the past 2 years with Exelon's, you know, constant lobbying for bailouts and subsidies, which is, you know, really, I can't put it any other way. It's really more a matter of greed than anything else.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Let me give you a break for a second while I tell you about my own experiences with Michael Schellenberger and Ted Nordhaus. They were originally funded by the Nathan Cummings Foundation, who were famous for products like Sara Lee. And they started that Breakthrough Institute in California. The institute, it turns out, was just an office in a plaza in El Cerrito, California. Michael and Ted appointed themselves as senior fellows, which was kind of an abuse of the common understanding of that word, usually reserved for people who had good academic standing and a lot of production in life, and these guys didn't. Michael's kind of a publicist, and Ted was a pollster. So now Schellenberger and Nordhaus's Breakthrough Institute has Rachel Pritzker behind it. She's the chair of their advisory board. And this Pritzker family has 11 billionaires in it with a combined worth over $30 billion. And on their website, the group Environmental Progress Illinois, which Schellenberger set up, acknowledges that they're funded by Rachel Pritzker. And incidentally, James Hansen is also on that board of that little group, and I wonder if he's paid to be there, but that's another question. So why did Schellenberger suddenly pop up in Illinois? He's a California guy. What's he doing there involved in this fight? And it turns out that the Pritzkers and the founders and CEO of Exelon, they rub shoulders all the time because the Pritzker family is so deep into Illinois politics. It's one of the most powerful families in Chicago. One of the current billionaires is Penny Sue Pritzker, who's the U.S. Secretary of Commerce. They've just been going at it together for a long time. And so what we're talking about here is kind of a billionaires club who seem to have engaged a publicist and a famous climate scientist to see if they can get some more money for their old reactors.
Well, actually, that's very interesting because I didn't know that. I didn't really know the source of Breakthrough's funding. I just know that Schellenberger has always said he doesn't take money from the energy industry, and he's been pretty consistent on saying that, so I've believed him on that. But now, yeah, hearing that, I can see why he doesn't need to take money from the energy industry. Yeah, I mean, it was quite a surprise to see them come into, you know, what is really a local battle, and it has to do, you know, with more than just what it seems on the surface, because, you know, the Illinois state budget is a mess. I mean, you know, things in Illinois frequently are a mess at the legislative level and at the state budgetary level. And that's, you know, part of the problem here is that these issues get drawn into larger issues in the state. But the reality is that Exxon has for 2 years now been saying that it needs subsidies to avoid closing uneconomic reactors. And actually the reactors that they cite have changed over this period. 2 years ago they were saying that the Byron reactors were particularly threatened. Well, then an investigation revealed that the Byron reactors were actually making money. So they went to Quad Cities. So, well, those are the ones that are failing. You know, we really don't know what to believe about from Exelon, whether these reactors are in fact unprofitable or not in the first place, because they don't provide the kinds of details that would make, you know, outsiders understand that. And B, why should Illinois ratepayers or taxpayers pay extra for their electricity just because it's nuclear, which is really what Exelon is asking for? And it doesn't make sense. And again, the only way you can make that argument, the only way you can frame it if you're on that side is, well, it will help save the climate. You know, I'm not going to argue that keeping those reactors running would be better from a climate perspective than replacing them with a coal plant, you know, for example. You know, nobody's going to make that argument, but that's not the choice we have before us. We have a choice of maintaining the status quo, which is a combination of wind and gas, and sort of slowly moving more and more toward wind, which is the trend, and away from gas, which we would like to see. We don't support gas. You know, we don't support fossil fuels at all, which, you know, is the other side of the choice, is putting up more solar and more wind in the state, which the state could use. That provides jobs, provides industrial activity, you know, helps build the economy. And so it's something that the state could use anyway. So, you know, their argument just falls apart, you know, especially when you realize that the amount of carbon emissions we're talking about from, you know, three reactors in the center of the country is, you know, when you look at the grand picture of things, it's pretty minimal.
Yeah, you published about this in an article called How Low Can They Go? That's in Green World Blog at safeenergy.org. And in that, towards the end there, you had to question your own belief in James Hansen, it seems. I mean, all of us have admired him. I continue to admire him as a giant in the climate field. But it shows that even giants can kind of have their blind spots.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, first it's important to remember there is a difference between being a climate expert, which I am not, and being an energy expert, which I'll lay at least, you know, some claim to, not full claim to, but at least some. Dr. Hansen is not an energy expert. He is a climate expert, and it is a big difference between the two. And for a long time, I sort of just chalked his pro-nuclear stance up to that. You know, this is, you know, I should be clear, Dr. Hansen has been pro-nuclear for quite a long time. That part of it is, you know, not new. I mean, he, back in, I guess, 2013, he wrote a letter to the environmental community, an open letter urging all of us to, you know, support these Generation 4 reactors we mentioned earlier. We and the Civil Society Institute, we being NIRS, and the Civil Society Institute organized a response. We had 300-plus organizations signed on to it, explaining why we were not going to take him up on that and offering to provide a venue to debate him on the issue. And he did not reply at all to our letter. Makes me wonder, you know, how serious he was about it in the first place. But over the years, Hansen has gone from someone who's advocating safer reactors and understanding that nuclear power has to be made cheaper because it's not, you know, it's not economically competitive right now, especially new reactors are even less competitive than the existing ones. And he's gone from that to someone who's, you know, advocating continued operations of the oldest and most dangerous reactors in the United States. And is also advocated, by the way, and he's gone to foundations and advocating not funding environmental groups that oppose nuclear power.
Oh, boy.
He's going, you know, he's gone directly to them and saying you should stop funding these groups. And that's not only groups like NEERS, which are, you know, exist to oppose nuclear power, but groups like NRDC and others who have, they're not even opposed to nuclear power. They're skeptical of nuclear power. And he's been doing that kind of thing. And, you know, that sort of goes beyond the pale a little bit, I think, in urging the idea that Illinois citizens who you already have a big state budget on their backs should pay more for their electricity just because it comes from these aging, uneconomic, and really unsafe nuclear reactors. That is an enormous difference. And for him to be, you know, what I consider so wrong on this issue, so out of what I would call mainstream thinking on this issue even, you know, if you read the local press, you know, even the business magazines or the business newspapers like Cranes, they're not supporting Exelon on this. A lot of Exelon supporters in the legislature are finding it difficult to support Exelon on this, which is why for 2 years Exelon has failed to get any of these subsidies. So for him to be that removed from what makes sense for Illinois and, you know, even what makes sense for the climate, because we can do better than these reactors for the climate, makes me question his entire body of work. And I hate to have to say that, to be honest, but it does.
Right. Well, I think we're going to have to leave it at that, Michael. We're starting to run out of time, unless there's anything that you'd like to add quickly as we wrap up.
Well, the only thing I would like to add, and this is sort of a fun little thing, is that our colleagues in Illinois at Nuclear Energy Information Service, NEIS, a little bit different from our group, but same kind of awkward name, recently took the letter that Environmental Progress Illinois sent to the state legislature. That's Michael Schellenberger's group, and Dr. Hansen was signed on to this letter. And they sort of added in their own comments, showing where Environmental Progress Illinois was wrong and why this is a terrible idea to bail out these reactors. And we published that on Green World, on our blog at safeenergy.org. And I think it would be a fun thing for your listeners to go to and take a look at, because it's a really good way to respond to the kinds of, you know, misleading statements these kinds of groups make.
We've been talking with Michael Marriott, the longtime leader of the anti-nuclear group Nuclear Information and Resource Service. You can find them at NIRS.org. And, you know, I'll put links for both groups and the Green World blog and everything we've talked about, really, in my own show blog, published every Wednesday at ecoshock.info. Michael, thank you so much for stepping up again.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
I'm Alex Smith. Again, whether or not we agree with nuclear power as a solution to climate change, that doesn't reflect on the science behind the new paper, Ice Melt, Sea Level Rise, and Superstorms. The scientific community is still divided on Hansen's new work. It will take time to evaluate it.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
David Archer mentioned that sea ice is not decreasing in Antarctica in a warming world, as expected in the climate models. That may be a good thing for the climate. We can get answers from a recent feature radio show on the Antarctic science done by Vivian Langford, host of Beyond Zero Emissions on 3CR Community Radio in Melbourne, Australia. Here is an explanation by Professor Tony Warby, the CEO of the Antarctic Climate and Ecosystems Cooperative Research Center.
Good evening, everybody. We're back now to the Antarctica show. And Professor Tony Warby is on the line from Hobart. He's an expert on sea ice. And listeners, if you look up ACE CRC, you can watch a fascinating video by Tony. He's the CEO of the Antarctic Climate and Ecosystem Cooperative Research Center. I'm delighted to have you on the Beyond Zero Emissions show, Tony.
Yes, lovely to be with you.
Oh, great. Thank you. Look, we live in uncertain times. And the work of your cooperative centre is to prepare government and business for the future. I'd like to know how that international cooperation is having results and how urgently you connect the burning of coal, oil and gas with what you see in Antarctica.
Well, I guess the first thing to say is that in relation to the work we do in Antarctica, it is highly collaborative. We work with a lot of different countries down there. There's a lot of international goodwill in terms of the science that we do. It's a very remote place, so it's logistically complicated to get to, and so there is a lot of international collaboration. And many countries really do increasingly understand the value that Antarctica plays to the global community, the importance of the research that is undertaken down there in informing problems that are relevant to the whole globe. While Antarctica may be remote, it actually plays a pretty important role in all of our lives because of the role that it plays in moderating the climate system, because of the climate services that it provides, in particular in the Southern Ocean, through driving overturning ocean circulation by the absorption of heat and carbon dioxide, and the benefits as well as some of the challenges that are being caused by those natural processes. And I guess to go to the last part of your question, we are seeing significant changes in Antarctica. We know that the ice caps, both in the northern hemisphere and the southern hemisphere, are changing. We know that the Southern Ocean is changing, and there's a clear indication that a significant amount of that change is driven by human activity.
We're in autumn here, and the sea ice is thickening up in Antarctica. It's at its maximum extent in winter, and apparently it turns the dark ocean white, reflecting the sun back into space. So that sea ice, I've been reading about this or listening to your video too, and that sea ice is really our friend in terms of slowing down climate change in this annual cycle. It reflects a lot of heat back to space. But is it getting less and less each year, like we see in the North Pole, or something different?
So you're absolutely right. Sea ice is a very, very important part of the climate system and a friend, as you put it. So when sea ice forms around Antarctica, and just to put this in perspective, the area of the Southern Ocean that freezes every year and forms sea ice on it is about 20 million square kilometres. And by contrast, the mainland of Australia is about 7.5 million square kilometres. So we're talking about an area of ocean which is almost three times the size of Australia, which in the summertime is just open water, and in the wintertime and by early spring is covered with something like a metre of ice. So when that ice forms, and you can imagine over that area, it's actually a vast volume of ice that forms, it squeezes salt out of the water as it freezes. So you might take the salinity of seawater is 33 parts per thousand. The salinity of the ice which forms from seawater is much less than that. And that means all that extra salt gets squeezed out into the surface of the ocean. It makes the surface of the ocean more salty and therefore more dense. And because it's denser, it's heavier, and because it's heavier, it sinks. And that's one of the main mechanisms by which vertical circulation of the ocean is driven. So most places you go around the world, the ocean currents are horizontal. Around Antarctica and in the Arctic, the same thing happens in the Arctic. It's this formation of sea ice that drives the vertical movement of the ocean. And that's important because the ocean needs to breathe. And so by sending the surface waters down to the deep ocean, you're sending water that's been in contact with the atmosphere, so it's rich in oxygen, it's going down into the deep ocean, and in turn that overturning circulation brings other water that hasn't been in contact with the surface for a very long time back up to the top, and it helps to replenish the health of the ocean.
Can I just interrupt there? In the video you said that people have thought before, that Antarctic sea ice was diminishing, just like it is around Greenland and in the north, the Arctic Ocean is getting less, sea ice is getting less every year. And they thought the same was happening in Antarctica, but you've found out that it isn't. So can you tell us that? Because potentially it sounds like a good news story.
So what's happening in the Antarctic is quite complicated.
But make it simple for us, please.
Yes, I'll do my best. So if you look at the whole of Antarctica, then there is a slight increase over time of about 1% per decade. Okay, so it's not very significant in terms of 1% per decade. If you were getting a pay rise of 1% per decade, you wouldn't be very happy with it. So in the context of, you know, of how much the sea ice is increasing, it is very modest. But it is still a very different signal to what we're seeing in the Arctic, where we're seeing declines of 5 to 10%, you know, over similar amounts of time. So what's happening in the Antarctic, though, if you look region by region, there are some areas where sea ice is declining very rapidly, and there are some areas where sea ice is expanding quite significantly. And the reductions in some areas and the increases in other areas are largely balancing each other out to this 1% per decade increase. Now, the thing that is driving some of those regional changes is also complicated, but it's partly due to the wind. So we know that wind patterns around Antarctica are changing. There's strong northerly winds or stronger northerly winds coming into the Antarctic Peninsula region, which is the area south of Chile and Argentina. And because those winds are coming in from the north, they bring more warmth, they bring more moisture. That whole part of both the land as well as the ocean is increasing as rapidly in temperature as anywhere on the globe. It rivals parts of the Arctic in terms of how quickly that area is warming. But there's a compensating change on the other side of Antarctica around in the western part of the Ross Sea. That may not mean much to many of your listeners, but perhaps the area due south of New Zealand.
Yeah.
And that area is actually experiencing more southerly winds, which means colder air is blowing off Antarctica more strongly, more regularly, and it's pushing, it's not only forming more ice when it hits the, when that cold air hits the ocean, but it's also pushing it north as well, which is resulting in increasing sea ice extent. So there are significant changes happening in different parts of Antarctica for reasons that are related to changing wind patterns, which we believe are related to changing effects in the upper part of the atmosphere as well. And that in turn is linked to the whole story around ozone depletion. So, you know, one of the beautiful things about the climate system is everything is linked. And trying to understand or unravel what's driving what and what's changing at any particular time and the reasons behind that and how much of it is part of a natural cycle, how much of it is part of an anthropogenic cycle is what keeps us busy.
Yeah. And as we just talked to Dr. Sue Cook, she said, you know, it's quite new, really. It's just this last 20th century that all of this science has been possible because we couldn't really travel to Antarctica before. And
that is just part of an interview with Tony Warby by Vivian Langford. We just have time for another excerpt from that Beyond Zero Emissions show on Antarctic science. Here Vivian interviews Dr. David Etheridge from the Australian Research Agency, CISRO.
Good evening, everybody. We're back now to the Antarctica show. I know this is the hard question. You're doing the science, but the people who are making the emissions, you know, the industries that are, you know, we've signed up in Paris to lower our emissions, and that seems to be going on completely separately from the research scientists who are telling us quite alarming things. If West Antarctica is melting quite rapidly and now East Antarctica, according to Tas Van Oemen, is twitching, it's got massive implications.
It does. And let's just go back to the research. Maybe a decade ago, most of the concern was around the Greenland ice sheet, actually, because Greenland is much warmer. The ice sheet is much more responsive to temperature. And it was expected, and the early models showed, that maybe there wouldn't have been much ice with a few degree warming. And that would have added sea level in the same way that the Antarctic did. But a program of ice coring there went through what we expected to be regions of no ice from a period of 100,000 years ago or so. But there was ice there. The upshot of that was that the Greenland ice sheet looks to be maybe a little bit more stable than we thought. So the sea level rise that we knew happened 120,000 years ago must have come from the Antarctic. So the next project was to look at, well, the next most susceptible piece of the Antarctic, and that was probably expected to have been the West Antarctic ice sheet, as you said. Now, recent results that we're getting from sectors of that ice sheet, and this is done through work with the University of New South Wales, showing that, in fact, there are extensive parts of West Antarctica that has ice from that warm period of 120,000 years ago. Now, that brings us back to the East Antarctic, because we know then that the East Antarctic must have contributed to some of that sea level. Mm-hmm. Now, that's a bit worrying, because we've, as you said, expected the East Antarctic ice sheet to be this big frozen, fairly unresponsive lump.
Mm.
Now, the ice core evidence is showing, well, maybe that's not the case. It was probably more interactive in that warm period. But also the more recent evidence that we're finding from the Australian Antarctic Program, which is going under the ice sheet and into these essentially chasms below the ice where ocean water is penetrating under the main Antarctic ice sheet, and showing that it could actually destabilise the ice sheet through warming and greater sea level. So this great sleeping giant, perhaps, as Dr. Van Ommen was saying, could be awoken, and I think that's now an area of intense research to find out how quickly that could happen and how much actual sea level could be added to from that region of Antarctica.
Well, would you say the melting in Antarctica is irreversible, unstoppable?
I think in our time frame, yes. The long-term evidence, you know, the geological and glaciological evidence of the ice sheets show that they do wax and wane through cold and warm periods. But over our timescales of, let's say, centuries, looking forward into the human future, I don't think we can see anything but a reduction in polar ice. It's just a matter of how much can we arrest that reduction. This melting of substantial melting of ice probably is quite a slow process. These are large amounts of ice. They're already quite cold. You have to add a lot of heat to them to get them to destabilize.
That was Dr. David Etheridge from the Australian Government Research Agency, CISRO. He was appearing on Beyond Zero Radio in Australia on May 6, 2016. I haven't done justice to that excellent full-hour program on Antarctic science with three guests from Vivian Langford on the Melbourne Radio Show. Find the program at 3cr.org.au/beyondzero or get a link in my show blog at ecoshock.info. We're out of time. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening. And please join me again next week for Radio EcoShock.
Radio EcoShock.
Next week, we'll be talking with the godfather of coral reefs. And this is British artist Ruth Mundy singing about love in the time of coral reefs.
to reverse things, well, at least not to cause worse things. And we decided not to. It was easier not to.